Hi, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum, the State versus Greg Lance, Episode 4. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and part of the audio editing team at Undisclosed. And joining me today is Rabia Chaudhry, best-selling author of A Non-Story and the host of Undisclosed and the producer of this season. Hey, Rabia.
Hey, how are you, Rebecca?
I'm pretty good. I'm really excited about our guest, Rabia. I don't know about you. Our guest this week is Ivan Bates. He's a veteran trial attorney with more than two decades of experience and a track record of success in the courtroom that is unparalleled. Regarded as one of the top defense attorneys in Baltimore City, he's a senior partner of Bates & Garcia, a law firm he started in 2006. He began his career as a prosecutor for the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office and has since been involved in many of Baltimore's highest profile cases. Because of his expertise, Ivan did what most lawyers only dream of when he argued a case before the highest court in the land, serving as co-counsel in Maryland versus Blake, argued before the Supreme Court of the United States. Ivan, it is wonderful to talk to you. Of course, I know you as the guy who ran against Marilyn Mosby and Thero Vignaraja in the election for the Baltimore City State's attorney. And I was rooting for you, even when I was watching the HBO documentary and I knew the outcome. I was like, maybe it'll turn out differently this time.
It'll turn out differently next time.
It will. Hello, Rebecca. Hello, Robbie. How's everybody?
Pretty good. And excited to talk to you about this, especially since I read your recent testimony that had something to do with firearms and the police handling of them in Baltimore. So I'm sure you have thoughts about this week's episode.
Oh, yeah. I do. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
And also with us is Susan Simpson, co-host of Undisclosed and the blogger behind The View from LL2. And she's also a super lawyer. Hello, Susan. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hey, Rebecca.
All right. Well, I'm going to give a quick synopsis of this week's episode of Undisclosed. For those who haven't listened, I suggest you go back and do so. In episode 4, we learn more about the evidence found at the Heron Farm. Bullets and casings, a mysterious pile of ashes, and a cutout portion of a shed. All this evidence was found during a second two-day sweep of the farm, although nothing had been found just days prior. They send this evidence to the TBI crime lab to be compared to the bullets found at the Klisnikow house and to compare the Tech 9 found on the Bohannon property. The lab succeeds in matching the bullets that killed the Klisnikows to the gun and also matching three bullets and one casing from the Heron Farm to that same gun. The murder weapon has been identified, but now tying it to their suspect is the big priority. The gun is traced by the ATF to a Mr. Daryl Smith, who bought it in 1991, but when investigators speak to Smith, he tells them he traded the gun to Robert Shepard of Shepard Auto Sales in 1995 or 1996. Shepard confirms that, but then loses track of the gun and has no record showing whether it was sold or stolen or what happened to it. The one witness says he saw the gun with Shepard in late 1997, a year prior. However, the gun disappeared. The investigation fails to connect it to their suspects, Greg Lance and Keith Herbstreith. Finally, the episode reviews the issues related to firearm ballistic identification science and how challenges in court concerning it have been handled. Rabia, going over why the appearance in the second search is problematic for the state's case, can you just talk about that second search and those bullets and why that's kind of a big deal?
Yeah, I mean, it was when I was drafting that part of it, I was like, how do I convey this? It's not easy to follow kind of what happened. And I don't know like how well I managed to make that clear. But the reason it's problematic is because the state has said that we had two searches, right? They either had like 5 days between the searches, the 21st and the 26th of August, or it was 2 days, according to them, the 24th and the 26th. We don't know which one it is. It's one of those 2 days. But according to the state's like, we were there on the 24th, nothing there. We were there on the 26th, and boom. So the problem is that in that 1 day in between, then they're making the argument that that is when Greg came out on the 25th, that 1 day, and that happens to be the day that Powell saw the smoke. And he came out and he was trying to get rid of evidence, okay? The problem is that evidence didn't exist there on the 24th. And by the admission of the lead investigator, TBI agent Krofzik, he's like, we checked everything. We checked the shed. We were there for several hours. There were five or six of us. It was a fairly thorough search the way he described it. So either they were there and they missed a billion, like, I don't know how many bullets. And again, what they're arguing is that, well, those bullets were not all in the, that ash heap didn't exist until the next day. So that means the bullets were in whatever was being burned, would have been that, which would have been that wall, right? But they also looked at the wall and there were no bullets there. And then we can talk about whether or not that wall could actually have bullets in it. So the question is, like, what are you saying that he came out on the 25th? Like, it doesn't add up. And that's the problem with it, is that if the bullets were there, they would have seen them. And if the bullets were not there, who was going to come out on the 25th, shoot a bunch of bullets from the murder weapon, and then try to burn it? Like, it doesn't make sense either way. That's why it's problematic.
But also, like, why? Like, why would he go there to, like, what was he doing there? Was he, the idea that he was, like, practicing for the murder and then realized, oh, hey, I practiced for the murder at my friend's house. I have to go back on this day. I saw them searching it yesterday, so I'm going to go back after the search and destroy all this evidence and cut out a part of the wall and burn it. Like, why do they think he would do that? I mean, that was the question I kept coming up with.
I mean, it's not unusual, and I know Ivan and Susan can both talk about this, when they're taking what they think they know and trying to connect it to this crime. And so they have to come up with a story that they can sell, or that maybe they think remotely makes sense. And what they do know is that on the 24th, the 25th, one of the agents called Mike Heron, who owns a farm, and said, can we do a search of your property? It was on the 24th, excuse me. And Heron said yes. And they found out later that Heron, when they called him back on the 27th, he's like, oh yeah, I told Greg that you were going to do it. Because they're like, did you tell him anything? Tell anybody anything? He said that, yeah, I told him, because you told me you're going to search it. You told me something's going on. I don't know what's going on. I didn't hear back from you. So then they're like, aha, Greg knew we were going to go back and search. So he showed up to, like, destroy evidence. And it was just, it just helped bolster their story, and they're connecting, you know, it's a way for them to connect Greg to the gun and the bullets, right?
Hmm. Ivan, do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, to me, it is exactly what Rob is saying, because if they don't connect him to the farm, to the location, to the bullets, to the location, and eventually they're trying to, with that gun, then really what do you have with him other than a person who did business, who was angry and potentially was in litigation? So to me, if by connecting him to the bullets, and the bullets are the same bullets that are also, I guess, used to kill the victims, at that moment in time, that to me is the connecting, quote-unquote, tissue to the gun, to Greg, and to the crime. So to me, that's a very important piece to make sure that there is a connection to these bullets outside of just the shooting.
But doesn't it seem tenuous? I mean, I have read, by the way, like as I mentioned earlier, the testimony you gave recently about, you know, the actions of Baltimore officers and the gun trace unit and all that stuff. And it seems very systemic. Like they have a process, you know, for the stuff that they do. Like this seems like very tenuous. Like this, like as connective tissue goes, it's not super reliable.
Well, it isn't, but one, this is a very heinous murder. I'm sure they don't have that many murders in that county. Once they've decided it's him, most of the people believe whatever the police say. And it's easy. Once the train is moving, they're not going to necessarily think about and question back in the 80s, you know, 1989. So when the police said it, they're not thinking the way that we're going to look at it and analyze it. They're thinking the police say it, so it must be so, and we're moving in this direction. And so it's easy. I think they were pretty unsophisticated in the way they brought it up. I think today they would be blown out the water with that type of theory. But back then, I think it was something that they said it made sense, and so we're going with it.
You agree with that, Susan?
I think they gambled correctly that the power of forensics, the power of, you know, saying science proves it, outweighs let's call it troubling or non-existent narrative. It's hard to understand what they say Greg did or why anyone would do this. But at the same time, since we have the absolute unquestioned certainty of science saying us that this is definitely the same bullets that were used to kill the victims, well, then it doesn't matter that the story is confusing. It doesn't matter that the narrative makes no sense, because science is it happens anyway.
Robbie, did Greg know he was a suspect in this murder at the time of these two searches?
I mean, he knew because by that time, I mean, like a couple weeks had gone by since the murder and the day that like they shaved his hands and took his clothes and you know, they did all this. He already knew that. But he had no idea that these searches had anything. He had no idea that anything at the Heron Farm had anything to do with that investigation. He didn't know right. Krofcik was involved because Krofcik is not the one who contacted Mike Heron. He was contacted by a different agent, Winkler. And I'm sure Mike didn't tell Greg that this specific person contacted. He probably just said, the police are out there. There's some funny business. Just check up on the farm. And Greg's like, okay, whatever. I mean, he probably just figured it was just people who live there or, you know, just people shooting up the way they do out in the country. But he had no idea this was connected to that. And Heron didn't find out until later, like until after the search, I think the 27th.
I have one question, Robbie. Do you know the exact date of the telephone call between Mike and Greg where Mike told him about the investigation? Was it the same day or the next day?
It was the next day, the 25th. And that phone call is actually really important. It becomes part of the state's case. That phone call, they track the phone call because when they talk to Mike, he's in Arizona in a motel over there working on this big construction project. And we have the phone record. So that phone call becomes pretty important. In this country, a burglary happens once every 23 seconds. And approximately 2 million burglaries are reported every year in the U.S. Census. By the way, 83% of burglars who are caught actually admit that they specifically look to see if a house has an alarm before they decide whether or not they're going to burglar it. But having said that, what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security. And that's probably because a lot of companies don't make it easy. In the past, I've had home security companies that do make it really hard. They're not that affordable. You're stuck in a contract for years. But here's the thing. SimpliSafe changes all that, and it is my top choice, hands down. First of all, SimpliSafe protects every single door, window, and room with 24/7 professional monitoring. It's not just your doors, it's the windows too. They make it easy. There's no contract, there's no hidden fees, there's no fine print. SimpliSafe has won a ton of awards from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. The prices are incredibly fair and honest because you get around-the-clock monitoring for just $15 a month. But look, the one thing that truly makes SimpliSafe stand out is their video verification technology. Now, when other home security systems are triggered, a lot of time the police assume it's a false alarm and the call goes to the bottom of the list, but not with SimpliSafe, because using their video verification technology, they're able to visually confirm that a break-in is happening, and that allows the police to get to the scene 3.5 times faster than other home security companies. Now, for our listeners, SimpliSafe has a huge deal going on right now. Go to simplysafeundisclosed.com and get free shipping and a money-back guarantee. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com today. SimpliSafe undisclosed.com today and protect the most valuable assets you own, your family and your home.
Rabia, I have so many questions about this shed wall situation. So first off, there's this idea, and you talked about this. They said they searched the shed the first time, but then you mentioned that when they had to find this, you know, missing piece of the shed wall, it was actually behind a wood pile, right? So they either moved the wood pile the first time, moved it all back, or they never actually moved the wood pile to begin with, right? Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one or the other. The agent said that the first time we were there, the shed wall was intact. It had not been cut out. And
right.
You know, that's part of the nefarious scheme that Greg had. So,
right. So then Greg would have then gone and moved the wood pile, cut out the shed wall, burned it, and then moved all the wood back. I mean, yeah. They're saying that he did that. Okay.
Well, they're saying he did that, but they also are kind of saying we did that too. They're saying that we, because on the second search when the police showed up, the wood pile was there. So, you know, it's one of, I don't know which one it is. I mean, like, did Greg move all the wood back or did the police, or Krofcik, the first search, look at the wall and then move the wood back? Either way, when they got there, the 26th, the wood was there.
Yeah, nobody moved that wood pile twice. It's just not a thing. I mean, there's no reason to move it twice, like, especially when you know the owner isn't there.
And stack it back
who
up.
Who are they stacking it for? You just
know.
Move it and leave it, right? So that's the theory. My second question was, they say the theory is that that was the portion of the shed wall that was burned and that was the cause of the smoke. It was there a piece of the shed wall in some ash they were able to say definitely that that is what was burned, or is that just, again, supposition and theory?
Yep, the latter. They didn't identify any piece of the wall in the ashes.
Okay, so they're literally...
I'm kind of grateful because I don't want to see like an expert in wall, forensic wall expert come in.
So it's like, it's just as likely then that like this piece of wall had been cut out because mice had, you know, dug some holes into it. And then in order to keep the wind from blowing in the shed, that's where they put the wood pile, right?
Well, you know, it's like just. So I asked Mike Heron, I was like, do you remember like that shed wall? Because my guess is that wall probably had been cut out from who knows when. It was probably already cut out from before. And he said that he can't remember exactly, but he does remember that there was a wood-burning stove in that shed at one point. And he thinks that there might have been something, and I don't know how wood-burning stove works, but a part of it that needed to go outside of the shed, like a pipes yes. or something.
Yes. And
right. So he's like, I remember there was a wood-burning stove and there was some part of the shed that it had to like extend out of. And he's like, that might be why the wall was cut like that. He's like, but I yes. can't remember. Yes. Is that a yes? Okay.
Yes. Well, I have a barn on my property. The previous owner had a wood burning stove in there. When he moved, he took the stove with him and there was a hole in the wall of the, like a big, big ass hole.
There you go.
And we had to like pay somebody to come out and cover up. Yes.
So maybe the real crime here is a stove theft.
Maybe. Yeah. But another crime is this. Another crime is that the defense counsel did not get Mike Heron up there and he testified and say, hey, because that was close enough to the time of the crime that he might have remembered and been like, why was there a hole in your shed? That's a real crime. Why the hell didn't they ask him that?
Hmm. Yes. And why, like, how do they know? I mean, I guess there are questions. Okay. So let's just talk about that hole because investigators testified to the freshness of that cut, right? Yeah. What did they say about that?
Well, one guy said that, you know, it was so fresh, there was still sawdust that was, and I mean, the pictures I have in our little draft, I don't really see any sawdust, but he said the sawdust was like fresh sawdust. And then Krofczyk said the same thing, and they're like, oh, we cut out a little piece ourselves to compare it with. I don't know where they would have cut out that extra little piece to compare. I mean, look, I am not a country girl. I don't know a lot about wood and fresh wood, but I do know...
Or sheds.
But I do know, like, if you cut a piece of... I mean, I think we all know what a fresh cut piece of wood looks like, right? It's like lighter color on the inside. You can tell it's fresh. It also has a smell. I don't know if these country boys needed to cut out a piece of the shed is what I'm saying. But this was a really important point that they had to drive home for the jury. And that was because what the argument they're making is literally Greg got a phone call the day before and he rushed out there and cut out this wall.
So the person that they are accusing of using gasoline to burn down an entire home, instead of doing that, would just cut out a tiny piece of wall and burn that instead.
Well, he did.
It was a nice shed.
Yeah. Mike Heron's his buddy. He doesn't want to burn down his buddy's property, maybe. I don't know.
Right. And there's also the question of whether or not those shed walls would have been something one would shoot bullets into, or whether or not bullets would actually have been in those walls, right?
Yeah.
They would not have been. They would not have been.
Yeah, I mean, I know nothing. Susan,
there's no way.
Is Susan the only one amongst us four who's actually shot guns?
No, I actually shot guns. I was in the military.
So, oh, there you go.
You know, I grew up somewhat in the country. I had a grandparents that had a farm down the country in Virginia. So we shoot guns down there in the farm.
I never shot a gun through a wall, though. I mean.
No. You know. You would line the wood up and the bullet's going to go right through it, 9mm.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because these are like the walls of the shed are just these planks. They look like 2x4s, right? Yeah.
And also, if I was trying to recover, like, say in this weird fluke incident, somehow all of the bullets get wedged into the wood. Wouldn't you just want to pry them out and take them with you? Like, the bullet holes themselves have zero forensic value. Why go to all the effort? Like, that seems like hard work to cut a wall out when you just do the bullets.
And the other thing, if you shot through the wall, then you would go ahead and have the pieces of the wall that are on the ground behind where you shot for when the bullet went through. So you'd have to pick all that up as well. So it just seems like it just made absolutely no sense to me because you just cut that out. Then you walk around and pick up everything else. It really just made no sense.
Ivan, let me ask you something. I raise this question every single time with every single case. Is it possible that this entire team from the local sheriff's office to the ATF to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, that this entire team of investigators, like 10, 12 men, could be that stupid?
You know, this is what I think. I think they decided the answer was going to be Greg, and they just need to figure it out in any way, shape, form, or fashion. How many murders do they really handle back in 1989? Yeah. How many murders of this type? And what makes sense to us today, back then it made sense to them. Oh, we're just going to say this happened. Oh, yeah, let's all go with that. And it's almost the blind following the leader. And they were going to say it was Greg, and they had, oh, well, yeah, what about this? This matches. Oh, yeah, you know what? Let's say he did this. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. Because why on earth are you just shooting right there? I mean, that didn't make sense to me either.
How much of this, and I think about this a lot, it's easy to talk about why the defense didn't call Mike Herron, for instance, and have him say, yeah, I think that's where the wood stove came out of the shed or whatever.
Well, they did call him to testify, but they didn't ask him that.
Okay. But also just the storytelling part of being a trial lawyer. You know, I've reported on enough criminal trials where I know, and murder trials where I know that like a huge part of it on the prosecution side is being able to put together like a narrative and being able to tell that story to the jury. But isn't it also like the onus also on the defense to do the same, to sort of take a story and say, all right, so put yourselves in the minds of a killer and imagine going to your friend's house, shooting bullets into a wall, then moving a wood pile and then moving it back and then cutting. Like, isn't that a missing piece here, too, that the defense doesn't do a good job of coming up with its own version of why the prosecution's narrative completely sucks?
That's always a hard call for a defense attorney. You have no obligation to put on any defense if they have a case. But when you start trying to make your own story up or to explain what really happened, you invite, one, the jury to speculate, like, maybe your client did it this way, or maybe your client did it that way. And two, you become responsible for that. If your explanation doesn't make sense either, the jury might blame you as the defense attorney, like, well, this is such a dumb explanation, they must have done it. They don't have a better answer for it. The state's lack of a better answer isn't bad for them, but a defense attorney or defense strategy that involves, like, a non-believable, that can get punished by the jury.
Is that your experience, Ivan?
With me, I always try to look about a theory and a theme. What's the theory of the case? What's the theme? What am I trying to say? And I think I try not to put so much out there, but I also try to just put enough out there so that it can answer a couple of the questions and that it's very strong on my end, the footing end. And so, I mean, I think from the defense perspective, I definitely would have tried to focus on why this barn has nothing to do with my client, and how their theory of it being important is important, but it has absolutely nothing to do with my client. And I think, calling his friend Michael, that's how they would have been able to try to prove that.
Even though you're not supposed
to prove anything on the defense side, I find, especially when it comes to murder cases, it's almost the jury's, especially back then, they wanted you to, well, prove to us in some ways that your client isn't guilty. Because I feel a lot of times juries want to find people guilty of murder. They're looking for a reason, especially a murder like this.
I mean, so can I just say that, while it's true that I think it's dangerous territory for a defense, I mean, they're doing kind of the same thing as the prosecutor's doing if they're just coming up with their own story. I don't think that's what they need to do, but they do need to demonstrate how absolutely incredulous the story the state is putting on. Number one, they can do that by asking, in this case, they could have done that by asking Mike Herron on the stand, why was your shed cut out? Do you know? Which they didn't do, but okay, let's say they had done that and the jury didn't really believe Mike Herron. That's his friend. You know, they've known each other for years. Maybe he would lie. It would not have been that hard to do a simple demonstration on videotape. Go to the shed or get a similar wood. And these are, again,
well,
that's
harder, you think, to get that in evidence. That has its own difficulties.
I mean, there's got to be a way to raise to the jury that is also from that same area. That have you guys ever shot into a 2x? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like you
I guess you
know,
do need a forensic wall expert after all.
Does it make sense to you
all?
That you would yeah. Does it make sense to you that you would move a wood pile twice?
Yeah.
Like, you're going to risk breaking your ankle twice? No, you're not going
to
do that.
What 2x4
you want the jury to ask
stop.
These questions. You want the jury to realize that there's holes. But unless you are damn sure of what really happened, you don't want to be responsible for making that story be out there.
Yeah.
Don't make it up.
Well, let's talk about another detail that struck me and probably struck other listeners. The bullets that were found, kind of found on the ground, hanging out, not embedded in anything, and not melted after they were ostensibly burned along with this missing piece of wall, allegedly, by Greg Lance. Can you talk about those bullets, Rabia?
Yeah, this was not something that I don't have any experience with bullets and guns. So I'm like, oh yeah, a pile of ashes. Here's all the bullets. That makes sense. And it wasn't until I had a long conversation with Mr. Heron, who knows a lot about guns and stuff. He's like, because he actually did not know this happens with witnesses. They come in for bits and pieces, just their portion of their testimony. And he doesn't know what's happening in the rest of the trial. And he's like, why is this stuff important? He was asking me why I'm asking these questions. And I explained to him, well, this is what happened. He's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. He's like, if those bullets were found in these ashes on my property, they wouldn't have been completely fully formed bullets. He's like, that stuff melts very quickly. And they, if at least would have been deformed. He said globs. He's like, they would have been globs. And I was like, really? So I started looking around and it seems like he's right.
But wouldn't that have been the point of the fire to begin with? Would be to destroy the bullets? That would have been the point, right?
That would have been the point, but I wonder, I mean, I will say that, right, but they emerge fully formed. I also wonder, though, even if they've been melted or deformed or into globs, you can probably still, the groove, maybe any identification marks are gone, but you can still tell what kind of bullets they are. But yeah, that would have been the point. So somebody really sucked at whatever they're trying to do.
Ivan, do you have questions about that? I mean, I'm excited to hear, by the way, that you have experience with guns because Susan being the only expert on the panel,
by
we
no
just
means.
Have to trust her.
My experience is occasionally firing random weapons for fun, so don't rely on me for that.
Yeah. And the same thing with me, you know, I in the military and just kind of growing up. But no, I don't subscribe to that right now. But you know, some people do. And what was interesting about this case, I instantly thought, how on earth did the bullets get there? Because for me, hearing that there was this fire, I instantly thought, well, they would have melted. Something would have happened. I mean, something would have happened. You could not match them. You could not trace them. And to me, it didn't seem like that listening to the podcast. I just really felt that, oh, those bullets came from someplace else. That's what I instantly thought, just from my standpoint. And it made sense that either one, the fire was there first and then the bullets came later, or the bullets were placed after the second search. And that's the other thing that I thought as well.
So when I first saw read a description of the basic setup at the Heron Farm, I mean, if you're thinking, trying to put together what happened in the scenario and you put aside the whole murder thing for now, my first guess would be like someone was using like a chunk of wood, like a stump or a log as target practice. And then they had a fire to like make some marshmallows and they used that log. And maybe that's where they came from.
Yeah, maybe.
Not a bad theory. Yeah. So let's talk about this tracking the gun. The buck stops with this guy, Shepard. I have never been a gun owner, so I can't speak to this. But by the way, I should mention, I have asked my husband, Kevin, for my birthday, which is later this month, to take me to a shooting class so that I can be more knowledgeable when I talk about these things on podcasts. So I will be attending a class at Sig Sauer Academy here in New Hampshire, just so that when I do these things, I don't sound like such a dope.
Ooh, wow.
but one of the things that strikes me is that Shepard just sort of has this very hazy memory. Like, I had a gun. I don't have it anymore, but I don't remember what happened to it. I imagine if you have lots and lots and lots of guns, that's more plausible than if you only have one or two. But what do we think about that? And Robbie, when you were like researching this, what did you think about that fuzzy timeline and that explanation?
I thought, so it's not that he's like a gun enthusiast who's just kind of collecting so many things and he can't keep track of it. This is stuff that's being traded to him. He's a businessman. He keeps pretty good records, generally speaking. And that was one thing that one of the agents noted was, how come he has like really great records of every single gun but this one? So I thought it was not a believable story, and they certainly didn't either. That's why they gave him a polygraph, and they weren't quite done after the polygraph. They're going to continue to pursue him in a different way. But I personally don't buy that he doesn't know what happened to the gun. I think when the day they reached out to him, he immediately was grasping for straws, and he's like, oh, yeah, I sold it to Tommy Jones. He's like, let me just, you know, make somebody up. I think I remembered something, you know. And then he also says that he sold it, like, pretty quickly after he got it, which was a long, like, 7 years prior to this. But then you have another witness who's like, yeah, I just saw him with it last year. It was at his place. So something else happened to it, and we have kind of a theory, but not exactly sure. He did have a couple of guns. I don't know if that was the only gun theft, but I think there was another one too, but again, he had meticulous enough records that he could say these are the guns that were stolen. And I would imagine that's important to know, because if, like this, one of your weapons that has been brought to your shop and you have records of having it, then gets involved in a crime, you want to be able to know where it went.
Right.
But not if the act of selling the gun was a crime. You wouldn't record that. I can think of a few cases where we've, in one case particular, I was working on in kind of a country situation where there was a gun that was very important to the case, and I was trying to track where it came from. And eventually I found the dealer, and he would not say anything on the record. And then finally, when he felt confident, like, it would never be reported back, he's like, yeah, I sold guns to minors off the books. Mm. And that's probably what happened to it for that case. Mm. So it could be that he was just doing a little side business. Nothing, I mean, sketchy, but nothing, you know, murdery. Just a 17-year-old wants a handgun. He'd be willing to sell it to him.
Hmm. What does it mean? So you did this bullet count, right? And the bullets that you think are connected to the gun add up to 31, one more than the gun would have been able to hold. Although you do mention that there could have been a bullet in the chamber, right? Can you talk about that?
I guess that can happen like that. Because, you know, this is you know, when I did the math, I'm like, wait a minute, there's 31. And he said that the clip said 30. So I guess, you know, that's one plausible explanation. And I guess bullets are loaded into clips, so you could have an extra bullet that you stick in the chamber after you have fully two other, you know, your other clips are loaded. So yeah, that's completely possible.
All right. Well, one of the things I'm really fascinated about, and I'm glad that you got into it in this episode, I'm really glad when any criminal justice story examines the quote-unquote science behind certain accepted evidentiary things like tool mark identification and, you know, being able to identify which bullets came from guns. You guys did a really great explanation of what's problematic about it. I'll also point people to season 2 of In the Dark, also did a whole episode on this that I would recommend listening to, that talks about, you know, just sort of the fact that whether or not a bullet came from a gun is determined by a human being looking at it and deciding, you know, not, there's no standard, there's no set of, you know, number of things that have to match. It really is just up to the expert to decide. Ivan, what do you think about this kind of evidence, and how is it handled in Maryland courts?
You know, it's interesting. Recently, there was a case, and you even profiled it in the Keith Davis murder case, Keith Davis Jr. case, in which you talked about the tool mark identification. And in that case, in the state of Maryland, look, it's a two-part test. One is a Fry-Reid test, and basically does any scientific evidence, is this testimony generally recognized? And that's the first part of Maryland. The second part is under Maryland Rule 5-702, the court has discretion to decide, based on this information and testimony, will it be helpful to the jury? Is the expert qualified? Is this material appropriate for the expert to testify to? And is there a proper factual basis? And if it is, then the court can decide that can be admissible. In the Keith Davis Jr. case, Debbie Levy, the attorney, she challenged that. And it was really interesting because she challenged it really in two parts. One, facially, looking at Maryland 5702, reliability, admissibility, what does that really mean? And is this quote-unquote junk science? Are there different standards? You know, it's subjective. What does that mean? But the real important aspect to me that I really think is important to look at with this type of science is, you know, how was this applied? For instance, when you're looking at an individual who's judging the tool mark, who's judging the handgun, the tool marks, you look at, you know, are they the types of individuals that ever get this wrong? What are the reports that talk about them making mistakes? What corrective actions have they done before in terms of making mistakes, in terms of identifying the different tool marks? One of the reasons I have problems with this type of scientific evidence is because it is subjective. What you see may be different than what another examiner sees. And so to me, that's when you look at this type of evidence, we really should be very cautious in understanding it, because it's just not by a machine, it's just by the human eye.
Yeah. Do you have thoughts, Susan?
In this case, this is not unheard of, I guess, but in this case particular, it's a good example of cases where experts rely on just their word. Trying to examine the validity of the comparison here is, you can't do it because there's nothing. All you have is the examiner saying, yep, they're a match. And there's nothing you can look at, nothing you can compare. nothing anyone looking at this case could possibly do to understand if it's likely or unlikely that they have a good match there. Because there's nothing to look at. All we got is the word of the examiner, full stop.
Right. And then you have the word of the examiner also accompanied by him or her also saying something like, in my opinion, and I've been doing this for 34 years, and nobody knows this better than I do. And juries like that, right?
I mean, it's very unchallengeable. Like, how can you possibly question that? Like, there's nothing anyone can do based on the record before us to say that they got it wrong or right or anything.
Right.
Unless the defense called their own expert, but yeah.
Yeah. Ivan, I'm curious, do you have questions about the case that you would like to ask Rabia and Susan?
One of the things that I was interested, it talked about the gun being rusty and how it was out there for about a week or so. Was it after the murder?
A few weeks.
Before it was found?
It was actually a little over a month. It was August 5th was the murder. September 17th it was found. And it was outdoors. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I was just kind of curious, the gun being out there. And to me, the other question I had, and I think you began to answer it a little bit with Mr. Shepard. I mean, to me, that's where the gun was.
He did. Yeah, he passed it just fine. And all the investigators, not only that, they kind of – this is an interesting tidbit about the polygraph. So the first time they called the polygraph examiner, he had a conversation with Mr. Shepard, and he said to the investigators, I don't even need to polygraph him. I know he's telling the truth. I can tell.
Well, you don't need to do it because it's bullshit anyway. So, he's not wrong.
It's bullshit anyway. And so this guy was very, very convincing. All the investors spoke to him and, they were just like, yeah, he just seems like totally on the up and up. And they went ahead and did it anyways. And he passed just fine. I have heard from a number of people that he's very glib. I mean, he is a used car salesman. No offense to any used car. But I heard he's very glib, and I've heard he's just really personable. And, maybe that's what it was, but I don't believe the story. I don't believe that he whatever happened to the gun, I think he knew what happened to the gun.
He definitely did, because one of the things that kind of caught me is that this Tech 9 was special. He had the other guns, but the Tech 9 sat alone, from what I understood, sat alone by itself in its own case. He understood what that Tech 9 was. He knew a lot of times you talk to gun owners, that gun is something special to them. And I've spoken to gun owners that own 15, 20, 30 guns, and they know almost each and every single gun and what they do, and they're excited about them. And I think even talking to some of the other, like I think Mike wasn't, I think he talked about the type of guns that they were fired and things like that. And to me, I really had a lot of questions and have a lot of questions with Mr. Shepard, because something's not right. I can see him selling the gun under the table to somebody, and he doesn't want to talk about who he sold it to.
Is the Tech 9 a semi-automatic pistol?
Yeah.
I'm right, right? Yeah. So are there like laws around owning or selling those kinds of guns, in that state that would make him less likely to want to say what happened to it?
No, they're lawful. I mean, they're kind of not unusual choice. They're very popular, but this isn't my opinion, but they're designed for people who want to feel like military badasses.
Right.
So they're a little bit, ginned up, but from a regular 9mm. They look like an assault weapon. They look not exactly, but they have that military Rambo air to it. So it's a little bit of an unusual weapon for the country to have just for like regular defense purposes. But it is the kind of gun you might have for fun or to show off.
Right.
And it didn't seem like, I mean, everybody who was questioned in this case, about what kind of guns they had, it seemed like, it was the kind of gun that they remembered. You know what I mean? Like it was not, people didn't have it commonly enough that they... but like Mike Heron never had one like that. Greg said he never owned one like that. Tommy Jones, like, nope, never had one. But I kind of remember one time, we did this robbery and there's one there. Like it seems to stick out. It doesn't seem like a very common.
It's an unusual looking weapon.
It's unique.
Yeah. It looks like, I looked it up. It looks from like a mini machine gun is what it looks like physically.
And also you have to remember it was in the late 80s. So guns weren't as quite as prevalent, especially those types of guns.
Late 90s, but yeah.
Yeah, late 90s. So that's something that they would have definitely remembered.
If you go on our website, there should be pictures of the gun in our episode documents, too, so you can take a look at what it looked like and all the weird stuff attached to it.
So I have a question about the way that you told this story and what it is you're trying to say, because you do bring up the issues with the way that bullets are matched to guns, and so that gun is determined to be the murder weapon. There's a lot of issues with that. Well documented. Anybody who's like really big into criminal justice reform has read those reports, sort of knows about that. And then we also talk about the very tenuous connection that they made between the bullets found at the shed, allegedly, and the bullets at the crime scene that killed the Kaliznikows. I mean, there's a decent case to be made that this Tech N9ne itself is not actually the murder weapon, or not. I mean, do you think it's the murder weapon? Because I guess that's the question I walked away with. Like, yeah, they really had to stretch to connect this particular weapon to Greg, but is this actually even the murder weapon?
I think it's highly possible that it's the murder weapon. First of all, it was found very, very close to the crime scene, within a mm-hmm. mile away.
Right.
And then the way it's rigged, the questions I raised in episode one, where I was like, how did somebody just sneak in on them, kill them with some, you know, like, pretty precise method in the dark without turning on the lights. And you know, I mean, so the flashlight attached to the gun to me kind of explains how that could have been done. The cord itself, I mean, it's a kind of a, what I understand, it's a heavy weapon. It's not easy. Like if you were like trying to slip in and out of a house, and it might be like one way you like lower a weapon in through a window, or it's easier
sling.
To carry.
It's
a sling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also wondered, by the way, Susan, you and I were out there. I also wondered maybe that was one way to, they could have flung it. It was easier to fling up.
That's totally what I imagined. I don't think that from a car it'd be hard to do, but I'd like the image of someone like standing there on the road, spinning it around in a circle and like whoop, over the fence.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't mean it could be. It definitely could. There's nothing to say it couldn't be. I'm less convinced that the gun is an effective tactical weapon. I mean, maybe it works that way. It was some pretty, it wasn't like a great modification job. It was like duct tape and a small flashlight. I would not say like, I feel like it's by any means certain that's the gun that was used, but I think it's plausible. The one question I have is I'm still a little bit iffy on the guy who found it, his story. He's not given, not like lying way, just a typical like memory changes over that long a period of time kind of way. But a lot of his stories make it hard to understand how he didn't find it sooner. He told us, like, he walked his, was it cattle or horses? His horses down there like, every day, like twice a day. So how did he not see it for a month? And the way he described it, he just looked down and saw it one day. Like, it was just suddenly there. It wasn't like it was hidden. It was just, you know, laying there by his little trail to his horses.
Yeah, I am more on the, I mean, I kind of get how someone wouldn't see something for a month. Because that's the kind of thing I feel like happens to me all the time, where I'm like, oh, there's still a string of Christmas lights on the gutter right in the front of our house that apparently everyone's been driving by and seeing, and I did not notice until today. So that's not so much it for me as, you know, this idea that, all right, so if this is, let's just be, you know, optimistic about it. If this is, in fact, the murder weapon, because the flashlight and so forth point to that, then the tenuous connection is that the bullets found at the shed were then matched to the same gun. So is the idea that those bullets were from a different Tech N9ne or from a different gun, or that the police potentially could have just been like, we really want this to be the case, so let's just shoot some bullets from the same gun and stick them here? I mean, has that crossed your mind, Robbie, that that is also what could have happened here?
Honestly, it's unclear to me what's happened here. I feel like there could be, so the sequence of events is the gun's not found actually till, was it September 17th? So that was actually after these bullets have been collected. Okay. It wasn't matched until like October. All this stuff wasn't matched until October. It could be that those are 9mm, that they found 9mm bullets on the farm, but they're not necessarily from the Tech N9ne. It's not like 9mm bullets are so uncommon, you can get them anywhere, right? I just don't know whether or not they came out of the weapon. And I don't, it's just unclear. I mean, that's the problem with this kind of stuff. Like when the state story does not make sense and nobody tries to fill the holes at that time and really figure out what happened, then all those years, it's hard to figure out exactly, you know, what really happened, what was the truth here. But they didn't find the gun until later. And when they found it, it had 20 bullets in it, apparently. So it's not like they could have, I mean, so in August when they did the second search, they didn't have those extra bullets to plant, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I don't know. They could be random 9mm bullets they found on the farm.
Yeah. Ivan, do you have any other questions about the case?
Well, I was also thinking there's so many different ways to look at it. For instance, they may not have thrown the weapon the night of the shooting. They may have had the weapon and, you know, kept it and then fired the bullets someplace else. And, you know, my question is, did Mike tell anybody else about the police coming and searching the farm or anything like that? What, you know, who else did he tell, if anybody? And, you know, maybe someone saw the police going looking at the farm previously. And I mean, there's so many questions that I think you just don't really have the answers to. I'm really curious the next episode to really find out about the string, I guess, that was wrapped around the weapon, what they found, what they didn't find. I just, for me, a lot of times I look at the reason why someone would do something. I still am not seeing the reason why he would want to do it per se. It seemed to me he was a hardworking guy who was trying to make something of his life. He was a little jaded with the business dealing, but a lot of times when you're in the world of business, that's what happens. And, you know, the other thing I didn't really get from his background that he was being viewed as violent or physically aggressive or anything like that. To go from being angry about a business dealing to going in the middle of the night, breaking into someone's house, killing them with the precision in which the shooter was able to kill the victims, and then burning their house down, you have to be a pretty cold-blooded person to do it like that, or else you hired somebody. Then the other part that is very interesting, did they look at their background in terms of the Ukrainian background, in terms of what they knew, what they didn't know? That, to me, the murder almost seemed to me to be so planned and carried out in almost a military precise way. That's what I thought originally. That
me
there's
too.
Something deeper with these individuals that we aren't necessarily looking at, and they just want to close this case, and it's high profile. The governor's offering money. So I just kind of felt that was a road that I would have looked at if I was the police.
Yeah, me too. Although I don't think an assassin in the Americans would necessarily fling a gun and have a string attached to it over a farm fence.
Or have a gun that's modified the way this one's modified. Or use duct tape for any kind of gun modification.
Right. So maybe it was somebody else just sort of playing at assassin. You know what I mean? There's so many possibilities. Yeah. But I agree with you. I actually think that the victimology here is a little bit more interesting than this one business deal. You know, it just really is. That was my first thought when I heard the podcast as well. I'm glad to hear we're on the same page, Ivan Bates.
Yes, definitely, definitely, definitely. Thank you.
Rabia, any final thoughts about what we should be looking forward to in next week's episode?
Yeah, in next week's episode, we are going to get into where we ended, which was since they weren't able to trace the gun directly to Greg, but they are damn sure it's him. They're going to find a way to connect the flashlight and the cord to him and how they managed to do that.
Well, I can't wait to hear that. And I can't wait to hear about what other, I'm sure, shady things will come up as you continue to report this story. Rabia and Susan, thank you so much for joining me to talk about last week's episode.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
And Ivan Bates, what a pleasure to meet you. I continue to follow your work, and it's just a real pleasure and an honor to get to talk to you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Robbie. Just thank you for having me on the show today.
Thanks for coming on, Ivan.
Thanks again to Rabia and the Undisclosed team for asking me to host the addendum this time around. If you like what you hear, if you like me, and you want to hear more about true crime and pop culture, I encourage you to check out Crime Writers On. It's the podcast I host about true crime and pop culture. I also host a little podcast called These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast with my husband, Kevin Flynn. Check that out. Thanks so much to the fearless wrangler of this team, executive producer Methil Telhan, who never fails to ensure we can all do our best work. Thank you so much to the brilliant audio editing skills of Miss Hannah McCarthy. I love you, Hannah. You're an awesome editor, and I love working with you. Thanks so much to the sponsors who support Undisclosed. Without them, this podcast wouldn't get made. So if you hear about a great product or service on one of this show's ads, support Undisclosed by patronizing that sponsor. Also, you can follow Undisclosed on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. Keep sending us your questions about the State versus Greg Lance series by using the hashtag UDAddendum. Finally, a big thanks to my team at Crime Writers On and Partners in Crime Media, especially my husband, Kevin Flynn, who's picking up a lot of slack so I can host this series. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening to the podcast, and we'll see you next week.